Welcome, friends, to another episode of A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar. We're super excited about the guest we're talking to today, somebody that we've both been hoping to get on the podcast since we started it. Shane Claiborne is going to be on the show. So we're going to be talking to Shane about quite a few things we've always wanted to ask him. We don't really have like a booker and like a set agenda or anything like we normally do. He's been gracious enough to be willing to talk to us about whatever. So we're going to ask him everything we always wanted to know.
Yeah.
It's going to be great.
True story. I've had a conversation with Shane Claiborne, and it was in the bathroom of a church in suburban Milwaukee at a urinal.
So going to need to hear that.
This will improve on that one, I think. But
excellent.
We also have something extremely special that we're tasting. Story Hill BKC. Let us know about this special release. It's a Bell's Brewing Imperial Rye Barrel Ale. It is about 3 years old. They got the barrel, which is one of about 50 nationwide that was released in 2018, and then they cellared it for about 3 years. So this has been sitting in this rye whiskey barrel for 3 years, just taking on the character and the goodness of the barrel. And really, he said, this is mostly for you, Kyle, because he knew this would just be right up your wheelhouse. And by the time you listen to this, you won't be able to. This is probably going to be tapped. It's a limited release at Story Hill BKC. But this is just an example of the extravagant things that Story Hill BKC has both on tap and ready to pour. So let's try this.
So this is technically a rye wine. I looked it up, which is a fairly unusual style. I guess somewhat similar to a barley wine, except without the barley. Tends to be very high ABV, tends to have a dark kind of malty, spicy profile. I've had three of them. This will be my fourth. Let's see. Smells amazing.
Wow.
Toffee, caramel on the nose.
It has the richness of wine when you smell it, so it makes sense.
Such a big flavor. Whoa.
Mm. Yeah, that's good.
Wow.
So mellow.
Mellow, yeah, I mean, it's a sipper, right?
Cellaring was a good idea. I didn't have it before, but there's just no, like, any sharp edges have been worn down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's caramely. It's malty. It's not overly toasty. The color is really dark brown, But you wouldn't imagine, I wouldn't imagine it being so mellow and really nice and smooth.
Yeah, if you've never had anything like this, imagine taking a bar of toffee and melting it down.
Mm-hmm.
And then mixing it with, I don't know.
Oh, what a treat.
I know I haven't had a bunch of the nicest beers, but I wouldn't even, if I did this blind, I wouldn't know how to identify it. I wouldn't necessarily say it's a beer. I haven't had many of the meads either, but it reminds me of a lot of the richness of that one that we had, or wine. It's just, it's crazy. Mm-hmm.
This is, it's coffee, it's chocolate, it's caramel, toffee, like you said.
Decadent.
Yeah, oh man.
Yeah, decadent's a good word.
It's kind of a perfect breakfast dessert beer, you know what I mean?
A bit like eating French toast or something.
Totally. This is crazy. I mean, in cellaring it for 3 years, that just takes on the goodness of the barrel, right? I mean, it's just getting more and more of that character. This is incredible.
Yeah, well, Joe, thanks.
Yeah. Story Hill BKC. Cheers.
Cheers. So we're getting a bunch of interesting reviews of the podcast on iTunes and Apple Podcasts, and we like to showcase some of those sometimes so that you guys who are doing the work of leaving the reviews get some positive affirmation, also a way of encouraging others to do the same. So we're going to read one here. This is from Ike1991, and they say, I really appreciate the way that they talk about relevant topics without taboo. Growing up in an evangelical Christian culture, there was one way to understand what Christianity was. Since I've started following the questions in my heart and taking them seriously, I've begun looking for different perspectives. They do a great job of discussing these issues from the philosophy and Christianity perspectives. So thank you, whoever left that review.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. This is your regular encouragement to go leave us a review. If you haven't already, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, or Facebook are the best places to do those. And also, regular reminder that we have a Patreon, and if you haven't subscribed, feel free to do so. So let's throw a shout out to one of our top shelf Patreon supporters who contribute monthly and allow us to have great production quality and a bunch of other fun stuff. So Josh Barnes, thanks for being a consistent top shelf subscriber.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hello, sir.
What's up?
How's it going?
I'm excited about the conversation. I was just looking over my notes from you here.
Yeah, we're excited too, Shane. Thanks for taking time, seriously. So our podcast is called A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar, which is why we're day drinking here. That's what we do. But I'm the pastor. We actually met You were speaking, it was one of your Milwaukee visits, and we chatted in a bathroom. Well, I asked you a question, and then I was peeing, and in the bathroom, I hear this voice, and you go, "Where did that question come from?" And I turn around, and it's you and your bandana, and we had a little conversation. This is years ago. This is Kyle. He's the philosopher of the
group. To block that one out, I think. The bathroom. Yeah. That's awesome. Good. Cool. Kyle, tell me about you, man.
So I'm a recent philosophy PhD. I'm currently job hunting and teaching at a place here in Wisconsin. So we actually met several years back at a music festival called Audio Feed that you spoke at. We shared some pizza and had a good chat. So
Audio Feed, remember it like it was yesterday.
Yeah,
A lot of a lot of loud music there. Yeah,
it's a nice, polite way to put it. Loud
music. Well, you know, I'm trying to think of what to call it, and I'm not sure what to call it, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I know the genres of music, but I'm not sure where some of that fit in.
No, a lot of it's intentionally genre resistant.
I might be genre resistant too.
In many ways. Yeah.
There you go.
This seems like a typical philosophy PhD. And you're looking for a job. I bet there's a lot of philosophers with PhDs that are looking for jobs.
With starting podcasts, yeah.
But you guys have the podcast going for you. It looks like you've had a lot of great folks on here.
We have, yeah. We've been very fortunate.
Yeah. All right, Shane, let's get started. Shane Claiborne, welcome to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walking to a Bar.
Yes. And I don't know where I fit into this picture, but glad to be here with y'all.
I think right in the middle in like this cozy little group here.
That's
creepy.
Absolutely.
Shane, tell our listeners a little bit about, like, everyone knows who you are, but how'd you get to where you are occupying the space that you're in within Christianity and within the church and within your advocacy work? How'd you get to where you are? I forgot how Southern you are. It's just a delight hearing you speak, because I usually read your words more than I hear you, but tell us where you're from and how you got here.
Oh, yeah. I grew up, I'm going to just tell you how Southern I am. How about that? I grew up in the hills of Tennessee, and my great-grandfather was the postman by horseback in the Smoky Mountains. When Dolly Parton won the Kennedy Award, I remember my uncle being on the couch going, "I remember when she used to play on the front steps." You know,
no, so
that,
way.
I mean, that's my world. Those are my people. And I inherited land that literally on the deed is Old Hag Holler.
That's amazing.
My mom went up to look at it, the land, and see how it was faring. And one pulled a gun on her. I'm the old hag. The road name. I kid you not. You can't make this stuff up. So anyway, that's my backdrop. And now, I mean, there's some not beautiful pieces of that. I grew up in a little town that was still very segregated, Maryville High School Rebels. That's my mm-hmm. high school. But it's also, we had the Confederate flag on everything. I mean, it was on our lunchroom trays. It was on our murals, football field. You know, when I see Jesus saying, you know, "Do you have eyes to see and ears to hear?" I guess over the last 20 years, I've been able to have some of the blinders, you know, ripped away and see some things differently. I did fall in love with Jesus down there, though. And, you know, I grew up in the Methodist church and also got a little bored in the Methodist church that I grew up in. I love Jesus, but I mean, I just wanted more, you know, and so I got involved in the charismatic movement because they believed in miracles. They believed in healing. You know, they got wild. I had to get rebaptized and go all the way under the water because the Methodists sprinkle a little bit, whatnot. Mm-hmm. So, and then, you know, and I think like that's part of all that has shaped me, you know, and then, of course, having some Catholic mentors and learning from Mother Teresa and, you know, different folks along the way, all that has really shaped me. So, I guess, you know, in all of our Christian traditions, you got some bones you got to spit out, but I think there's some things that are worth holding on to. So what were we talking about before we went on the air? Genre, what was it? We were saying some music is genre immune or something like
that. Genre resistant, yeah.
Yeah.
Genre. So I love Jesus, and I've been shaped by lots of genres of Christianity, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you have a distinct moment when you went from, "I've got Confederate flags on my, you know, lunch trays," to, "this doesn't really work with me and Jesus"? Was there a moment, or was it just this kind of evolution?
there was a curiosity, right? And I guess there was a suspicion that I felt about some of those things. I started to see some contradictions in the church, you know, like we said we were pro-life, but we really only talked about life before birth, you know, and like once you were out of the womb, you're on your own, baby. Every other life issue, the Christians were the problem, you know? So I saw all that, but it was really when I went to Eastern University up in Philly that I chose Eastern. Because I like the charismatic side of it, that you know, like the worship felt very authentic and real. And I got to go to some chapels before I decided to go to, you know, that was the college I wanted to go to. But then it was also really diverse, especially for an evangelical Christian school. So I enjoyed getting to know folks that were different from me, like especially, you know, I mean, really African-American folks. I grew up, you know, in my high school, just to tell you how small the town was, I was prom king. and the prom queen was one of the, you know, few African-American women in our school. So I'd always been like really comfortable around folks that weren't white and stuff, but that was part of what drew me to Eastern was I wanted to have that world, the kind of little world I grew up in, cracked a little bit more. So, but you said, is there a moment? And I tell you, I can remember it like it was yesterday when I put my high school yearbook on my shelf at Eastern and there was a Confederate flag on it. And my friends were like, dude, what in the world? And I was like, oh, it's my high school yearbook. They're like, yeah, that thing's not about football team spirit, you know? So,
Wow. So you alluded to Mother Teresa a few minutes ago, Shane. You spent a couple of months, I didn't know this, but you spent a couple of months working alongside Mother Teresa in Calcutta, who's now Saint Teresa of Calcutta. Can you tell us about that experience, how formational, but just tell us about Mother Teresa, goodness.
Well, the backdrop for it was that here we are, you know, and we're 19 years old or whatever in college, studying the Bible, studying, trying to figure out how to live out the radical, you know, gospel of Jesus. And you start to think, well, there's all these wonderful saints, you know, Francis of Assisi and Oscar Romero and, you know, Rosa Parks and, you know, Dorothy Day, Martin Luther King, all these people that already died. And yet we started going, who's still trying to live out the Sermon on the Mount, who's trying to sell what they have and give it to the poor? And we became really fascinated with Mother Teresa. So we wrote her a letter and asked if we could come, you know, work for the summer. She didn't write back and that didn't stop us. So, you know, we're 20 and nothing's impossible. So we called nuns until we got a phone number. literally, this is before the internet, y'all. So we had, you know, we were in a phone book at a payphone in the lounge
Good
of our
you.
Dorm. People don't even know what that is anymore, but you put coins in on young people. She picked up the phone. It was like $3 a minute. So I wasn't small talking. I'm dropping quarters in that phone like crazy. And so I asked her if we could come work and she said, yeah, come on out here. And we did, a couple college friends and I. And I went back after she had passed away, but that has also been, you know, so formative for me. I worked in, I just read about this stuff. You know, I worked in her orphanages in the morning. I worked in the home for the dying, her first home that she started in the afternoon. We'd take people off the streets who were dying and bring them in and take care, like mostly help them die with someone holding their hand, you know, not alone on the streets. Sheesh. And it was grueling work, but holy work, beautiful work. And, you know, so much about my prayer life was shaped there. I was just telling someone the other day, like Mother Teresa, at one point I had been asked to read the scripture in mass and I didn't even know how to do that, you know, because Catholics, it's not just like you throw open the Bible and read it.
You gotta
say something before and after. And I was like, I'm reading this in front of Mother Teresa. She's the one that asked me to read it. And I know I need a little lesson in Catholicism 101 or something. So I learned a lot though, you know, when I was over there, and more than I know how to put in sound bites, you know, but I've written a lot about it. And, I mean, one of the places that was just so, so impactful was, I mean, technically we called it a leper colony. I don't know if you would say that today, but it was a village of folks who had skin diseases and who they themselves, you know, knew as leprosy. So in the caste system, they were totally outcast. And, you know, if you've never been to India or somewhere like that, it's hard to imagine, but you can't go in stores, you can't go in restaurants. You are literally, I mean, it's where we get the the word outcast, you know, you, and so this community was formed along the train tracks. Mother Teresa got this land donated and like 300 families lived there. And I had a real unique opportunity to spend some time there. And man, I mean, just unbelievable. You talk about a village that was autonomous from its, like they had built this place, and, you know, had their own fish hatchery. They grew their own food. They made their own clothes. They had wood crafters that would custom make an arm and a leg out of wood for people when they, you know, were amputees, because that happens with the disease. So, I mean, it was just stunning. So that's been a big part of my formation. And even, you know, as I think about community, that little community of folks that were outcasts in India have really inspired a lot of the vision that I have for what it looks like to live in community in the world.
Wow. Wow. So in your 2008 book, Jesus for President, such a amazing and really prophetic book. It's a book about the politics of Jesus and nationalism. Since then, we've lived through the election of 2016 and 82% of evangelicals voting for Trump, and new polls suggesting that possibly 30 million Americans support QAnon in some way, shape, or form, right? There's, and many of those identify as Christians. And then January 6th happens. All this stuff is building towards where we see this overwhelming tidal wave of Christian nationalism and the church going in that direction. You visited one of these churches. You know, we have the Patriot Church and then Greg Locke's church. I don't even know what it's called, but you visited and wrote about it. What? Tell us what your thoughts are in this wave of Christian nationalism, where you see this all heading in the church, and just your impression on it.
Well... interestingly enough, I think we're getting ready to re-release Jesus for President. And, you know, my buddy Chris and I that wrote it together, we had a great team, but we went back and looked at it. And I'm like, man, I'm not sure we'd say anything different. There's just some things that we would highlight and underline and a little bit more. Like, pay attention to this. You know, like if I'm looking back to when we first wrote that, there's not much that's happening now that's surprising to me, although it's no less tragic, I think, as we see so many things unfolding in our country, and many of them with, you know, Christian bumper stickers and flags as they do things like what we saw on January 6th. So I believe, you know, I've said a lot of times that Trump didn't change America. He revealed America. Well, and I think that's been true of the evangelical church, too. It's not like Trump was this, you know, thing that radically changed evangelicalism. A lot of this was below the surface, the conspiracy theories, the fidelity to radical, you know, kind of ideas that are overtly racist and things like that, you know. So some of that history, I think, is just kind of getting aired. But he certainly unleashed some of the worst principalities and powers, you know. And
so, Shane, if it was beneath the surface, which I totally agree with you, is there any way, shape, or form that this unveiling of the racism, of the nationalism, of the, you know, conspiracy theory, you know, fodder, is it in any way a good thing that it's been in?
Well, I think the truth sets us free, right? As Jesus said. And so when you have things that are sort of trying to camouflage themselves as Christianity, and you rip the mask away and you see what it really is, I think that's helpful. But there's just a lot of damage being done, right? There are people that think they're rejecting Christianity, but they're really just rejecting a version of American nationalism that's trying to camouflage itself as Christianity. And it doesn't look anything like Jesus. And ironically, that's one of the things that I think is an anecdote for some of this, is to center Jesus again. And one of the best correctives of Trump evangelicalism is Jesus. Because, you know, here's Jesus blessing the poor and saying, as you welcome the immigrant or the stranger, you welcome me. I mean, Jesus is, it's hard to really twist Jesus's words. I think that you can use the Old Testament, you can use some things that Paul said to try to, you know, clutter the words of Jesus. But once you really center Jesus, it's hard to justify the indefensible things that Trump did and said, and things like what happened on January 6th. So I think we name it as a heresy. And there's no doubt in my mind that hundreds of years ago, when, you know, the early church and other Christian councils were happening, that they would have named this kind of American nationalism as a heresy of the church. I mean, that probably some parts of the church might have done more than that. I'm not interested in taking anybody out. But, you know, I think naming that is really really helpful. So I, you know, but I also believe that Matthew 18 calls us to directly confront or interact with our brothers and sisters when they are in danger of distorting our faith or doing things that are missing the mark, as sin means, you know. And so that's part of why I have personally reached out to folks that, like Sean Foyt and Greg Locke, and others that some of us, we have some mutual friends, you know. And so I'm not one of those guys that likes to be throwing stones at somebody at all, but especially from a distance, I want to talk with people, not at them. So with Jerry Falwell Jr., I'm not sure what he's doing now, bless him, but you know, but the, like Franklin Graham, others, we've always tried to reach out and talk with people, not at them, and not just tweet about them.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any success with that?
I'm still working on the you know, I mean, dialogue, you know, memes, it's a two-way thing. Yeah. So, you know, but what more can you do? And Matthew, you know, Jesus is actually really wise and unsurprisingly, you know, like, but telling us, go talk with them. If they don't listen to you, then bring a couple other people with you. If mm-hmm. they still don't listen to you, then go public with it, you know? And I think that's the kind of trajectory that Jesus kind of offers us. So that makes a lot of sense to me, you know, and I hope people have the respect to do the same thing to me when I'm out of line. I don't pretend to be above reproach here. Yeah.
That's so good, Shane. So I'm sorry, Kyle, just real quick. I mean, I've been astounded at your level of respect and dignity when I've seen you engage Sean Foyt on Twitter mm-hmm. and others. And it challenges me because I think almost all of us have friends or family who fall into this Trump cult, in this, you know, Christian nationalism. And it's so hard for me to understand, for me to give grace, for me to love. But I know that's what I'm called to do. What is loving our brothers and sisters? And you even said maybe this is a heresy. So are they our brothers and sisters in Christ? That's a question. And then also, how do we love these folks who we're in relationship with, we're kind of stuck with, for better or for worse? And I'm called to love my family members who are giving themselves to this craziness. And it's really hard for me. What are your thoughts, Shane?
Well, so that's really kind of you, but I think it's really great that in the beginning of this conversation we went in a little bit more depth than my backdrop, because that is so important to me, that I've been on this transition, you know, the whole scripture that says we work out our salvation with fear and trembling, right? Mm-hmm. This is not just about a moment, but conversion is something God's doing in us continually, and that gives me a little bit of grace and a little bit of patience with folks. For instance, when people tell me that, you know, when we're talking about the death penalty and they whip out, you know, a verse from Leviticus or something, I'm like, hey, let's talk about that. I'd love to talk about that. And you know, I have patience for that argument because I've used that argument. You know, like, and so I kind of think, you know, how much grace would I have if I met myself when I was 18 years old, you know?
That's good.
And we need that right now. There's a lot of self-righteousness. And it's not partisan. You know, there's folks on the left and the right that I think have this sort of self-righteousness that Jesus called it toxic. You know, he said it's the yeast of the Pharisees. It's very oppressive. And mm-hmm. because I think that we end up sort of being theological police. We end up being moral gatekeepers. We decide who's in and who's out. And I grew up with a conservative form of that, you know, the old don't smoke, drink, or chew, or go out with girls that do, you know. But there's obviously a progressive form of that has a different litmus test, but yeah. It feels the same, you know. So I think that's always dangerous. And the last thing I'd say about like who's in and out, which is a dangerous question, are these my brothers or sisters, you know, as you said, I would just keep, rather than saying, you know, it's my job to decide who's in and out, I think that's God's, you know, as Jesus said, the wheat and the weeds are growing together, so it's not up to us to try to figure that out. But I would say this, that the word Christian means Christ-like, it means little Christ, you know, that we're to be mm-hmm. imitators of Jesus. And we know what Jesus was like. Jesus is the full manifestation of God. This is what God is like, right? If we got any questions, like, look at Jesus. And Jesus is love with skin on, love made manifest, even to the point where when he's being tortured and killed, he's mm-hmm. saying, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. Like, that's what we're called to imitate. So I would say that we know a little bit about what the essence of Christianity is, and it's Jesus. You know an apple tree by the fruit. You don't look at an apple tree and go, I wonder if that's an orange tree or a plum tree. You know, like, you know it by its fruit. And so if our Christianity is not about love, let's not call it Christianity. If whatever religion we prescribe to is not about welcoming immigrants and refugees and finding some orderly, you know, way to do that well, like, let's not call it Christianity. If it's not blessing the poor, if it's not blessing the meek and those who are hurting and mourning, then it's not Christianity. So we can say this is something that feels to me like Jesus, or does, like the testing the spirits, as scripture says, you know, but that's a little different from saying Greg Locke is going to hell. I'm sure not going to say that.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We wouldn't want to say that either. But I mean, I think there's a difference between saying somebody's going to hell and saying they're not a Christian, right? That they're not honoring the baptism that they claim.
Yeah. And I'll be honest, the things that I've heard him say are really, really concerning to me. And this is why I, for Sean Foyt, you know, this worship leader that was, I don't think he's there anymore, but formerly at Bethel, you know, and I just think that there's so many concerning things, you know, when the Rolling Stone did the Jesus Christ Super Spreader article.
Good grief.
He really embraced that and began selling Super Spreader shirts on his website. Yeah. So, to me, that's at the very insensitive and unchristlike, but it's also, you know, it's one of those things that we can confront that. But part of what we're torn with, y'all, I think, is like, how much airtime do you give this stuff? And on the other hand, I think the best corrective to what's wrong is singing a better song, is living out a version of faith that, as much as we can, is honoring Christ and honoring those who are vulnerable, you know, in our society. So, yeah, it's a delicate dance, isn't it, on some of that stuff. So at Red Letter Christians, we say we want to change the narrative by changing the narrators. And some of the loudest, most public voices haven't been the most beautiful. So on the one hand, we do challenge some of the, you know, televangelists and preachers that are trying to defend Trump and whatever, you know, racist thing that's been said. But I think we also want to keep the constructive program, you know, proclaiming the good news of Jesus.
Yep. So, switching gears, Sean or Shane, you identify. Oh, geez. All right, here we go. Switching gears, Shane, you identify as a pacifist, or as you would say, a peacemaker. On our show, Kyle, this guy is self-identifies as a pacifist. I haven't been able to go that whole way yet. I'm waiting for you guys to convince me. For me, the nonviolent peacemaking way of Jesus is a way of life that I've given myself to, and I want to give myself more and more to. But it feels idealistic on a big, large national scale to hold to a pacifist ideology and way of working as a government and as a nation. Tell me
why. By idealistic, you really mean naive, right?
In some ways, yep.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with being idealistic.
yeah, not realistic is what I'm trying to say. So tell me why you think pacifism is realistic why Joe Biden should say, we're done with war and we're done, we're going to, you know, take away the 100% of the federal defense, you know, funding. It's all, you know, in some ways that'd be brilliant, but in others it sounds like we're just committing, you know, we're just killing our nation. So tell me why you think it's not idealistic, why it is realistic for the United States and any other nation to be a pacifist nation.
Well, so I think we can look at history and make a reasonable argument that violence has worked to solve international conflicts. I think we can also make a rational argument that nonviolence has worked and point to some really specific places. So to me, the bigger question than what works is what looks like Jesus, which is the way of Jesus, because it didn't look like Jesus's preaching of love worked on Good Friday. And I mean, like, the story did not end well in a certain sense, right? And please, I think we also have to remember, like, even as we think about violence that we see today or evil in the world that we live in, I mean, you're certainly not saying this, but some people would sort of paint it out as Jesus lived in this totally different world that they didn't have people like the Taliban, you know, or ISIS or something. You're like, actually, there were the historians, you know, in the exactly when Jesus was living, said that there were so many crucifixions on the horizon in Rome that you couldn't enjoy a good sunset. they were slaughtering people on crosses. Herod was killing little babies all over the land as Jesus was born. So, I mean, I think that context becomes really important for Jesus preaching love and living out love, right? Like when Jesus is saying love your enemies, I think he knew fully well what human beings are capable of. And so this is what I would say, is that I don't know how I would act in every situation, every hypothetical, you know, but what I do aspire to is to resist evil without mirroring evil. I believe that oppressors can be resisted without being emulated, that we don't use the same weapons that are used against us. And Dr. King really came to that reality. At one point, he was a gun owner, you know, thought, I mean, like many people, probably thinking, I might need this sucker, you know, and then realized we're not going to win the fight against violence, the fight for peace, using the weapons of violence, you know, even if it costs us our life, which it did for Dr. King, right? So when Jesus says greater love is no one than this, than to lay down their life, I believe that. I believe that you can have other things like courage that can be violent, can use violence. And that's why Gandhi, it's interesting because Gandhi, you know, championed for nonviolence. He said, if I have to choose between a coward and a soldier, give me a soldier, because that passion, that courage, the willingness to die, like, can be channeled into love, but you can't do much with a coward. So I think we've got to be willing to die for the cross, as willing to die for the cross as people have been willing to die for the sword. We've got to, you know, put as much resources towards life-giving alternatives to the things that are the sources of violence than we've put towards our military weapons, which, I mean, it's just unimaginable the amount of money. We've got, you know, over 50,000 Hiroshima bombs. Mm-hmm. Why would anyone need one Hiroshima bomb? We're the only people that have used these weapons, and we killed hundreds of thousands of people twice in 1 week, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, that's the kind of thing where, you know, even folks that are, you know, adhering to a just war theory, I would definitely challenge. I would challenge whether you can even have Augustine's just war theory in a world with drones and with nuclear weapons, right? Because it violates the very grounds. You're the philosopher over here, right? But like it violates the very grounds that he formed the just war theory on. But in the end, I don't follow Augustine. I follow Jesus. And I find it really impossible for me. And this is one who grew up with guns. I grew up with a dad in the military. So none of this was like no brainer work. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't grow up Mennonite or something. So, but I grew into this understanding that I cannot love my enemies and simultaneously prepare to kill them. Yeah. I just don't think that I can hold the cross in one hand and a weapon in the other. And I'm very open to dialoguing with other folks that are working that out, you know, but that's where I am. And, you know, I mean, one of the clearest cases of that is when Peter picks up a sword to protect Jesus, and Jesus scolds him, tells him to put the sword back, heals the guy Peter wounded. And Tertullian and the early Christians said that was the final triumph over redemptive violence, right? They said when Jesus disarmed Peter, he disarmed every Christian. Because if ever there was a case to try to use violence, a case to be made to use violence, it was Peter had that case.
Yeah. So you mentioned the Mennonites. We both share a fascination with, or I suppose an honoring of, the Anabaptist tradition. So can we just drill a little bit deeper here, if you're willing to? What can we say about the Christian's relationship to the state in general? And what is there that we can learn from that Anabaptist tradition? How has that shaped your thought about that?
Awesome. Well, I'll give an affirmation and maybe a gentle, friendly critique of the you know, for folks. By the way, when I first heard Anabaptist, I thought they were saying anti-Baptist. You know, I was like, why do they like it? Why do they not like the Baptist so much? Because, and for folks that don't know, the Anabaptist tradition, you know, has been the peace, one of the streams of the Peace Church, really committed to nonviolence, to sharing possessions, to community, and have been a real inspiration for me. So I think the thing that I would affirm, and what we really kind of dive into in Jesus for President, is that this was about a profound and subversive new way of thinking about ourselves in the world. That we were, when the early Christians said, Jesus is Lord, they were saying Caesar is not. Yep. They found themselves a part of a different empire that was subverting the power structures and the oppressive structures of their time. You know, when Jesus talks about the kingdom of God, it was the same word as empire. And he talked about it coming on earth as it is in heaven. Then you see the descriptions of it in the gospel. And you're like, the last are first, the first are last, the mighty are cast from their thrones, the lowly are lifted, the hungry are filled with good things, the rich are sent away empty. You're like, holy cow, that's not Karl Marx. That's the gospel of the Lord, you know? So that pronunciation of, you know, that flipping the whole world upside down is what they were about. And that's why they were crucified. You know, they were killed. They were called enemies of the state. You know, they were in the book of Acts in the New Testament, it says, you know, they're proclaiming a different emperor, one named Jesus, and they're creating havoc all over the empire. So this was definitely a sense that our hope is not in Caesar. Our hope is in Jesus. Our citizenship is in heaven. Now, I think how that works itself out is that some people can end up with this idea that this is all just about going to heaven when we die. And we can end up, you know, with the old saying, like, we're so heavenly minded, we're not much earthly good. And so there can be sort of an escapist theology that this world is not our home. And that's why, you know, was it back in the day, old Mark Driscoll or somebody said, you know, that's why we can drive SUVs with a smile because we're expediting the apocalypse. You know, that we're just going to let this world go to crap because Jesus is coming back and we'll make it happen faster. So that's like whacked out, crazy theology. But I think that what I would say about the Anabaptists is that there's still this sense that we want to be a part of the transformation of the world. The kingdom is not just something we go up to when we die, but something we're to bring on earth while we live. So what does that look like? I think it includes policies and structural changes to the world that we live in, right? Like Martin Luther King, he knew this well. He said, no law can make you love me, but it can make it harder for you to kill me.
Right?
So many of these issues, for instance, like gun violence, people will say, well, that's not a gun issue. It's a heart issue. And there's some Anabaptists that would say that, right? And I would say it's both, right? So God heals hearts, but people change laws. And, you know, in the civil rights movement, only God could change a racist heart. No, you can't legislate love, right? You can't change someone's heart by, you know, enacting laws. But we did need laws to change so folks could swim in the same swimming pools, you know, so that people could vote, black folks could vote and women could vote, and so that we could have a more just society. So I guess that's what I would say. And some of that's hanging out with folks like Reverend Barber and people in the civil rights movement, realizing that the Anabaptists have something to offer us, but so does his historic black church. And so do the liberation traditions that see that God is redeeming all things. So the question becomes, what does it look like to have some of our governmental systems redeemed? What does it look like if America were shaping policies by love rather than by fear? And you know, whether it's immigration or guns or the death penalty, I think our faith should cause us to care about policies as well. So loving our neighbor as ourself means harnessing the powers of our government that are hurting people. And I still got my anarchistic tendencies, please, y'all. I mean, Dorothy Day's been my mentor from a distance. So I see voting and things like that as doing damage control, as trying to,
that's a great way of putting it,
you know, harness the principalities and powers that can work in our governmental systems.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I like the, you know, using the black church as kind of a corrective for some of the more insular aspects of Anabaptism, which we have to admit has tended to be white. But a thing that I have liked about the Anabaptist tradition, reading people like Hauerwas, for example, is that the emphasis on building a kind of alternative community as a way of modeling what a structure could look like that was based on love. It's kind of what drew me to Anabaptism to begin with. But I'm just going to confess to you, because I want to get your take on it, see if you ever feel like this, that I've been kind of losing hope in that vision, particularly in the last 5 years. As you can imagine, something happened in 2016 that might make me lose hope in that vision. And I find myself conflicted now in my commitment to those ideals that you just described, because I find that empirically, it seems to me that the American church is just incapable of doing that. That certainly on a large scale, it's very difficult to find examples anymore where I think that's actually happening. And it seems to me, in fact, that the government, as messed up as it is paradoxically more capable of serving the ends of the kingdom at this historical moment. And I mean specific concrete ends. So things like caring for the poor, protecting the marginalized and vulnerable, healing the sick through things like healthcare, combating climate change, taking care of the planet. I mean, these are like urgent life, all like life transforming on a humanity-wide scale issues that need immediate action. And if we were to turn any one of those things I mentioned over to the church, we'd all be screwed. Mm-hmm. So I find myself these days thinking that if someone comes to me and asks, okay, what is the Christian's relationship to the state? What should I do? I'm more inclined to tell them, go vote Democrat.
Which, as a church leader, Bruce City Church, I just want to point out that Kyle said that, not Randy.
Yeah, this okay? is my, sure, yeah, sure. So I'm less inclined to tell them that kind of story about building an alternative community and that kind of living the way of Jesus, even if you need to do it a little bit apart, whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm more inclined to say, that's the ideal, but man, we're in the thick of it, and you got to make some more time decisions, so to speak. And right now, the best way to do the work of Jesus is to get some political moderates in there. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. So just a few thoughts on that is so one of them is about where our hope lies, right? Like where, and I like that old hymn, like our hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. I think that's, mm-hmm. that is a profound, you know, pronouncement. And that's what the early church was saying. They had very little hope in Caesar and changing the world. And so I think we have to really, I would suggest not have our hope in the Democrats or in the Republicans or, but you know, this idea that we're grounded in the lamb, not the elephant or the donkey is really core to my theology. I also don't have like folks that are working for good. The prophets are, they don't distinguish between who's in power, whether they're, you know, Jewish or, you know, in the New Testament, whether Christian, like they're calling for justice for the poor, no matter who's in power. And they're advocating for that. And the fact, I mean, one of the things that I got really struck by is that, let's just think about one issue, the death penalty for a second. Like if every Christian governor were to take this, their faith seriously enough to say that, like, to be blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Like, we would end the death penalty if it weren't for the support of Christians in America. Yeah. And so that really began to trouble me, right? Yeah. Like, Greg Abbott in Texas is responsible for all the executions so far this year, except for one, I believe, all the state executions. Like, Texas is just killing people. And Governor Abbott is justifying the death penalty even after going to mass on Sunday, you know? And mm-hmm. so, like, it's the same in Tennessee. Bill Lee is a Christian, and yet he's using the electric chair to kill people. So that, I think, like, part of the question is, what does it look like to hold office as a Christian, you know? And then the bigger question is, what does, you know, what's God's dream for our country? Well, I mean, literally in Matthew 25, Jesus said, all the nations are going to be before me, and you're going to be asked a few questions, and they're not going to be doctrinal questions. They're going to be, when I was sick, did you take care of me? When I was a stranger, did you welcome me? When I was hungry, did you feed me? When I was in prison, did you come visit me? Those really are the criteria for that final judgment, right? So I'd say, you know, America might want to, you know, do a little self-check on some of these things. But, you know, the real test of our the health of our society is not how the Dow is doing, but how the poor are doing.
Oof.
And mm-hmm. and so that's, you know, that and that's not partisan. And just to give you one more example of this, I like your shirt, by the way. You got the We the People ride, you know,
yeah,
the bike ride at the border. I've been thinking of them. And here's the deal. Like, welcoming immigrants, that should not be a Republican thing or a Democrat thing. That's a God thing. It's a love thing. It's a Jesus thing, right? You welcome mm-hmm. the stranger, you welcome me. And some of the highest numbers of refugees and immigrants have been welcomed under Republican presidents. Some of the lowest yeah. were under Trump, but Biden's numbers are lower than Trump. Biden's military budget, is higher than Trump's. Like, some of the things that I hold as core values are the parties betray those, right? No matter who they are. So I think that's where we, you know, we work with good. Like that's why going like, this is my fidelity, is to Jesus, to welcoming immigrants, to protecting life. And I would say, I want to reduce the number of abortions. I've been really discouraged with how the Democrats have navigated abortion. I'm also think that what's happening in Texas is just straight up nuts, you know? And so like, that's not the right answer, but like, how do we have a better ethic of life that sees every person made it in the image of God? Let's talk about pro-life on gun violence, the death penalty, and abortion. I would love to talk about how we can effectively reduce the need for abortions in our country.
Man, so you mentioned my shirt. We're talking, I was in New York with some friends who call themselves the Common Good Coalition or Common Good Christians, Doug and Shelley Padgett and Brian McLaren and many others, right? You just rode, there's a bike ride happening right now that started in, I think, San Diego, right? And is going to St. Augustine, Florida, trying to raise awareness for the border crisis and immigrants. You spent, I don't know how long, Shane, a week or two riding your bike with them?
I was there for a little less than a week, but I am hoping to go back. Yeah. And they're doing 3,200 miles. You're exactly right. California to Florida. So I did the most I had biked in a day before that was probably about 30 miles, but we busted out over 60 miles and, you know, over 100 miles while I was there. So it was incredible. But it wasn't just about the miles. You know, it's about these amazing people we're meeting with and the tragic stories that we heard.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, my butt hurts just thinking about, you know, riding 100 miles on a bike. But for many of us, for most of us, I would say this immigration policy is theoretical. It's, you know, politicians debating and arguing and us not really knowing the personal side of it. You rode your bike down the border. Tell us, just personalize it for us. What did you see? What did you feel? What was the spirit speaking to you as you rode your bike along the border?
Well, I'm a big believer that proximity makes all the difference in the world. You know, when we're talking about immigration or the border crisis, or I mean, almost anything, you know, folks on death row, like I think we need not just ideologies, but we need relationships. And that's what this was about, is about building friendships along the border, hearing the things that are happening and hearing everybody out. I mean, that we organized to meet with Border Patrol and hear their perspective. And so, I mean, it was just, even just a few days I was there, just stunning. You know, some of the folks that we met have even been charged with criminal charges for putting water in the desert and trying to show hospitality to immigrants. But then there were other things where, like in Agua Prieta, I think I said that right, they have worked out a relationship where when folks are apprehended, rather than going to jail or a detention center, they're brought to this mission run by Christians, and they welcome folks, they take care of them, they really, some of them, they're nursing back to life, you know, they're dehydrated. And it was an amazing place. It was also a really hard day that we were there because they had had someone die in their care, and so we were putting a memorial out to that person. And we listened to some of these stories, you know, and you think, like, why would someone risk their lives and go to all that trouble? Well, here's why. Like, I mean, this like 20-year-old dude, he's a young father from a remote island in South America that depended on cruise ships. When that tanked during the, you know, coronavirus, they had no money. I mean, they're literally facing hunger. His daughter needs health care. And he's like, what would any dad do? I got to figure something out. And he said, you know, we asked him, how long did you think it would take? And I'm not using his name on purpose, but he said, you know, maybe 2 weeks. And it ended up taking over 6 months for him to get to the border. And at one point he was so dehydrated, he's looking for water and he sees a gas station, but it's filled with Border Patrol. So he's describing like the feeling of thirsting to death while you're looking at water and not being able to drink it. And I think they found like a kiddie pool in a backyard, drank some water, kept moving. He eventually collapsed unconscious, and that's how he was apprehended. And we met him. I mean, we're sitting listening to this dude, tears in his eyes the whole time, just thinking about his daughter. And sweet Lord, I mean, you know, that's why the not just using these polemics and these rhetoric of, you know, MS-13 and rapists and murder. I mean, that's why we need to have a better process for people able to seek asylum and citizenship here. And but anyway, it was incredible. We stayed with this family, right, that had a ranch, and so they had like multiple houses in the desert, and they took like 15 of us in overnight. And they were a Mennonite family, by the way. So this is beautiful, Anabaptist at your best. And so they, you know, have these houses that folks can use because they're on a route that many people are coming in. And so, you know, we're talking, and they said, yeah, we just had some folks stay in one of the houses. And we said, well, how'd that go? Do they, you know, someone mentioned it, you know, do they steal anything? They said, no. They actually ended up doing our dishes as well as their dishes. So I kind of take that line with me. You know, these folks that crash there, you know, because the house is left open with the, you know, the light on, you're welcome to stay here. And they stayed and did all the dishes and cleaned the house for them. But, you know, I think that fear is what we've got to really address. So much of our policies are, I mean, even this wall, you know, all of it, so much is about fear. So we were saying, what would love look like? And one of the powerful images you probably saw is a worship service along the wall where, you know, folks on the Mexico side and folks on the U.S. side sang songs to each other and then served each other communion by passing it through the wall. So I look at that and I'm like, that is what we should be doing, right? And you know, Dr. Martin Luther King, y'all asked about what should the church be doing. He had a great way of understanding this. He said, the church is not meant to be the master of the state or the servant of the state. The church is meant to be the conscience of the state. Come on, somebody, right? So that conscience, that's who we're meant to be. We're not the tool of the state. We're not like trying to wrestle our way to power of the state. We got a different way of thinking about things, but we are the moral conscience. We should be in our society.
This episode is brought to you with support from Morley's Maple Syrup. If you're trying to find a thoughtful gift that says more than, I have Amazon Prime, Morley's Maple Syrup is a great idea. They have several pre-made gift boxes of Wisconsin-made maple syrup, like the Coffee Lovers box, which of course includes coffee-infused maple syrup, the Breakfast box, the Syrup Lovers box, and my favorite, the Grill Masters box, which includes bourbon maple syrup, which we tasted previously and loved. Go to MorleyMapleSyrup.com to find all of those options and lots more. Once again, that's MorleyMapleSyrup.com.
So I'm going to drag us back to our previous conversation for just a second. I'm still struggling with this should be versus are, right? The reality of it. So let me make it really concrete, hypothetical here and just see how you answer this. Maybe this is an unfair question. I don't know. Let's say I'm a billionaire and I come to you and I say, Shane, I'm going to give you $500 million. Here's $500 million. You have to invest it in one place. Do you give that money to the church? And if not, where do you give it and why? As it exists, like right now.
Well, I guess I would say I would give it to the work of the kingdom, as Jesus would say, you know, so.
Right. But let's be specific. Who's doing that work?
Yeah. So for instance, when I wrote my first book, I didn't make $1 billion, but I did set up a Jubilee fund to share the money of that book. So when you buy The Irresistible Revolution, we disperse that money to about 200 different groups. And some of them are congregations. Like, hey, this mission that I just described on the border is a Catholic mission. It's the Franciscans, right? I mean, it's old school, you know, but I would also give the money to the different missions that we visited that are doing incredible work. And some of them are faith-based, some of them are not, but they're doing the work of the kingdom, you know? So I see that the Spirit works inside of the institutions and outside. I even see that in Jesus. Mm-hmm. He's going to synagogue. He's Jewish and he's doing Passover. But he's also expanding where we think God is confined, right? Yes. So he's healing people with mud and spit. He's doing the work of God in the streets. So I think that the answer to that, bro, would be for me, where I see God at work in the church, I'd put the money there. Where I see God at work outside the church, I'd put the money there.
Yep.
All right, I will allow that evasion.
Yeah. Shane, I'm preaching through, just on a really practical level, I'm preaching through the Sermon on the Mount as we speak, right? Sweet. I've been doing it for a couple months. And as the further I go and the more I study and the more I reflect on the Sermon on the Mount, the more I realize how little of the Sermon on the Mount and how little of Jesus we actually have in our day-to-day Christian lives in the church, really, honestly. And it's it haunts me a little bit, even in my own life, right? I mean, the Sermon on the Mount is a hard ideology to reckon with and to follow. But when I think of who's done this well, I think of people like Mother Teresa, who, you know, you spent time with and we talked about. And I think of you, honestly, and the work that you've done and in doing things like setting up a Jubilee Fund when you write a book. Who does that? In reckoning with the Sermon on the Mount and our everyday American life, what are your thoughts on followers of Jesus having Roth IRAs and saving for retirement? What are your thoughts on building personal wealth for myself or for ourselves and, you know, trying to build a business to be super successful? And, you know, the capitalism, the world that we live in sets itself against the Sermon on the Mount and the ideals of Jesus. How should we practically live and follow the Sermon on the Mount? Is there a place for building personal wealth? Mm-hmm. Is there a place for all these things that our culture tells us to do?
Wow. Well, let me know when you figure that out. I will say I'm working hard enough on the log in my own eye that I don't really have a lot of time to pick on other people's, you know, the speck in their eye. But when, you know, in my own aspiration to be faithful to this, I find it really hard to stockpile for tomorrow while people don't have enough for today. And I mean, Jesus literally told a story about that, right? This guy that builds a barn to put all his stuff in and has so much stuff, he's got to build a bigger barn. And God's just kind of like, no, tear it all down, man. Like, you don't even know what tomorrow holds, you know? And so this idea that we are not to like worry about tomorrow, but to live like the lilies and the sparrows. I mean, that's from the Sermon on the Mount, right? And it's absolutely why I've got a like really big spider coming down over here, just so you know. And my wife left it because I'm living in a school bus right now, but we have these stink bugs. And so my wife tells me last night, yeah, just so you know, there's some spiders in here and I've left them because they're eating the stink bugs. So I'm sure everybody wanted to know that, but I've got a war of stink bugs and spiders that are now my pets in here. But anyway, okay. So, but you know, so I think here's the tricky thing. We've so created this idolatry out of individualism that there's not a real safety net of community unless you're a part of like the Amish or the Mennonites, right? And I've sometimes joked that like if things get really bad, I'll just have the go join the Bruderhof when I'm dying so they can take care of us, you know, because they have this infrastructure of community. And that's what ideally I think we want to build. When Jesus was telling his disciples to sell everything, if you look at like, I think it's Mark 10, where he says, leave everything. And he says, you will have a hundredfold, but right. So you're leaving your biological family, but you're joining a massive family. You're leaving your personal possessions, but you're entering a commonwealth. You're not going to own a house, but you're going to have homes everywhere you go. Right. So it was this vision that like, we're opening up our personal possessions, but we're joining this big family that's going to take care of each other. And we're trying to establish some of that in our little modest ways. Like we have a compassion fund now called Common Change. I think it's commonchange.org, where we're sharing hundreds of thousands of dollars. Whenever there's a crisis, we can like help each other out. You know, we need things like that. I joined a community of folks that are sharing medical bills because a lot of us didn't have health insurance for years and years and years. So we would every month get a newsletter of the medical bills of this group. We'd pull our money together and we were meeting like, I think it was $15 million in medical bills every year at one point. So like that, I think we need alternative infrastructures like that, that are communal based, that are, you know, the common good. And ideally that's what our government should be. I think folks that are trying to do their best to protect, make sure that everybody has the things that they need when they're functioning at their best. Right. So, yeah. So all that to say, like, but there are ways that we can live into that vision, you know, by trying to create some of those alternative infrastructures, by living with less, you know, the old saying, like, live simply so that others may simply live, I think is a beautiful one. And that's what Gandhi said, like, there's enough for everyone's need, but there's not enough for everyone's greed. And when you got like, I mean, sweet Lord, we got like 3 billionaires now that own the same amount as 50 countries. Like that's crazy. Like, I think Bezos is making like $3,000 a second or something like it. It's like over $300 million every day. So those, like, the inequity between the rich and the poor is absolutely insane. And it's also like why things like the Jubilee were originally created, right? Like God's like, you're going to get this inequality. So every periodically, you're going to need to release everybody from debt, set slaves free. Yeah. Like you're going to need to like redistribute property. Imagine if we had a Jubilee in America. I mean, that would repair some things.
Which unfortunately, there's no evidence that the Israelites actually practiced Jubilee, but the idea of it is from God. And
that's why I always quote my friend Ched Myers. You know, he says Christians have never really done the Sermon on the Mount either, but it was still God's intention.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And what I'm hearing you say is you can't do that by yourself. You can't live out the Sermon on the Mount on an American individual basis. Communally, maybe we can.
Yeah, I think I don't distinguish between the personal and the like communal, because I think that's where some people end up going. Like Jerry Falwell Jr., for instance, he said when they asked him about how he reconciles his loyalty to Trump and to Jesus, and he said, I don't look to Jesus when it comes to shaping my political beliefs.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that, you know, this idea that Jesus just teaches us how to live as individuals, but like his teaching has no political implications. I think that doesn't make any sense to me, right? Jesus is teaching me, yes, like Shane Claiborne, if you see an immigrant or a homeless person, you need to welcome them. When you welcome them, you welcome me. But also like why that same truth is you know, that's true for our country as well. So I think politicians are not exempt from the Sermon on the Mount.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So we want to honor your time, but you said you're good with a few more questions. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Cool. So can we talk about the death penalty a little bit? This is something that you've advocated for. Probably I've seen you speaking on this the most in the last several years of all the things that you're involved with. So can you share with us why you're committed to this issue, how it became important to you? Why do you think it is that, maybe this is an overstatement, but I don't think it is. When it comes up in class, in my classes that I teach, this seems to be the case. Like the kind of default position of most Americans is that the death penalty is just kind of an obvious good. Or if not a good, it's at least something that it makes some rational sense and it should be there even if it's just rarely used or something like that. So why are you so strongly against it, and why do you view it as an entailment of your Christian convictions to work against it?
Yeah, for sure. I'd love to talk about that a little bit. So I, you know, grew up like many Christians, calling myself pro-life, but then began to see how narrowly we thought about what it means to be pro-life, mostly only in terms of one issue of abortion, right? And I think a lot of pro-life folks would be more accurate to say they're pro-birth or anti-abortion, because on so many of these other life issues, we've been not the champions of life, but the obstacles. And the reason I've done so much work on the death penalty and gun violence, these were my last two books, Executing Grace on the Death Penalty and Beating Guns on the Gun Violence, is because it's like that old Pogo cartoon where you go, we met the enemy, it's us. Right. So like the death penalty would not stand a chance in America if it weren't for Christians. Almost 90% of executions happen in the Bible Belt. And where Christians are most concentrated is where the death penalty continues to hold on. And these are also the former Confederate states, so we can't miss that. You know, where the states that held on to slavery the longest are the same states that are holding on to the death penalty. And so all that's, you know, very, very troubling to me. But one of the reasons the death penalty is so important is because we worship an executed and risen Savior, right? And we're in danger of missing the entire point of the story, which is that Jesus put death on display, made a spectacle of the powers of death in order to subvert it with love, forgiveness, and an empty tomb. And the whole point of that story is that no one is beyond redemption. Jesus is like water poured on the electric chair, short-circuiting the whole system of death. So now I think anytime we try to defend the death penalty, we betray and undermine the work of Jesus on the cross. Ooh. And I know there are folks that are going to see that differently, and I was one of them. For instance, Russell Moore just reached out to me. We're going to have a conversation. He asked me to talk to him about what he's got wrong on the death penalty. So I'm Russell Moore, you know, formerly of the Southern Baptist Convention. I think we can say formerly, like that's his roots, you know. But I love that. We need better conversations on it. And there's so much at stake, right? There's so much at stake. There's people that are innocent, like Julius Jones and Rodney Reed, that I believe without any doubt are innocent of the crimes that they have been convicted. Folks like my friend Derek Jamison, who spent 20 years on death row before he was proved innocent and is now out, of course. But, you know, like how much do we trust broken, imperfect human systems with the irreversible power of death? And that's why some conservatives have problems with the death penalty, because it raises the question, how much do we trust the state, among other things, right? But I think it raises one of the most fundamental questions of our faith. So, you know, is anybody beyond redemption? Where sin abounds, grace abounds all the more. So do we really believe that stuff, right? Now, the guns, I'll just say quickly, when I started looking at guns, the highest gun-owning demographic in America are Christians. White evangelical Christians. We own guns at a higher rate than the general population. Two-thirds of Americans live without guns. Two-thirds. And yet, like, one of the most armed groups in America are folks that are worshiping the Prince of Peace on Sunday and packing heat on Monday, right?
So, I mean, let's not kid ourselves. They're packing heat on Sunday, too.
Yeah.
Yes, they are. So, but, you know, very different versions of power. And one says, I'm willing to die. And the other says, I'm willing to kill. One says, turn the other cheek. The other says, stand your ground. And so I think that's where we've really got to challenge, not just the guns, but the logic, the fear, the militancy that becomes, that really is behind our idolatry of guns. I mean, literally, we have scriptures saying, don't put your trust in chariots and horses, but we sure are putting our trust in a Glock.
So I have a couple follow-ups about the death penalty, but before I get to that, part of your ministry is actually pounding guns into farm implements, right?
Yeah.
Like gardening tools.
Absolutely, yeah. Inspired by Isaiah and Micah, you know, that we'll beat our swords into plows and spears into pruning hooks. And let me just say that these are not disconnected, right? Some of the most credible voices in the movement to abolish the death penalty are survivors of violence. Murder victims' family members who see violence is the problem, not the solution. And so, like, while we've been on this call, I got a Reverend Sharon Risher called. I didn't take her call. She's one of my heroes, but her mom was killed in Mother Emmanuel AME Church. Two of her cousins, her childhood friend, like, her family was killed by Dylan Roof when they were in Emmanuel at Wednesday night prayer meeting, right? She's walked out of that an advocate for common sense gun law changes. We need to address the hatred, the racism, the violence, and the policies on guns. But she's also an abolitionist against the death penalty. She thinks Dylan Roof, he's so filled with hatred right now. Like, he doesn't need the electric chair. He needs to understand. He needs Jesus. You know, he needs to understand how big God's love is, and that God's love can even heal him of his sins. So, I mean, boy, so these things are connected, and we've done gun transformations with Sharon Risher. As she was beating on the gun, she named all nine of the Emmanuel Nine that were killed in that church. You know, we've seen folks that have experienced some of the deepest pain, but they realize that the death penalty does not heal the wounds of violence. It just creates new ones.
Yeah. Oh gosh. So Shane, I'm just going to wrap it up here. I mean, we've been talking, we've been talking about, you know, the death penalty is in effect because of Christians. You've said, we've talked about how immigration so much grates against the modern church. We've talked about how all of these things that are just depressing, Christian nationalism and building walls and all of this stuff that just causes one to be pretty depressed about the state of the church in America right now. What gives you hope when you look at the church in America right now, Shane?
Well, there's a lot of bad music out there, but I don't go to a terrible concert and give up all music.
Yeah.
I think the difference is that a bad concert doesn't do like real soul damage to you. You just walk away going, that was terrible, you know, but the church has done a lot of damage. And so I think we've got to begin with a posture of humility and of confessing some of those things. But I also like, I think, you know, even in an abusive relationship, like you leave that, but you don't necessarily give up on love, you know? And I think that's where we've got to find a better version of Christianity. And this is nothing new. Frederick Douglass named this, you know, he said there's between the Christianity of this land and the Christianity of Christ, I see the widest possible difference. So this is nothing new, but I would say for a lot of people that are leaving one version of Christianity, that may not be the end of your faith. It may be the beginning of a better, more robust faith. So I'm stoked right now because I see a church that is rising up. It's a lot of that's happening in my purview outside of white evangelicalism. But I mean, I think of Tracy Blackman in Ferguson after Michael Brown was killed, and Reverend Barber in North Carolina, and Michael and Ben McBride out west, Leslie Callahan in Philly, Michael Waters down in Texas. Like, there's just, you know, there's folks in different traditions outside of the white evangelical kind of toxic Trump evangelicalism that are shining the light of Jesus. They're fighting for justice. They're going to jail for the good trouble. Like, those are the circles we need to keep leaning into. And, you know, I mean, it was true even for Jesus. His harshest words, like brood of vipers, were for the religious people. And so I think those contradictions are ancient. But we know, you know, God is at work. God's bigger than the embarrassing things that we Christians have done in his name. So thanks be to God.
Amen.
Can I ask you one real quick other question? It's not on the outline. It can be off the record if you want. That's fine. I'm just curious. So I think it was last year sometime you tweeted that you were writing a book with someone else about abortion. And there was quite a bit from my perspective on Twitter anyway, there's quite a bit of backlash about that, particularly from women saying things like, you know, the last thing we need is another man writing a book on abortion, including some rather prominent Christian writers. So I'm curious how you received that kind of critique. I haven't really seen you say much publicly about abortion since then. Maybe I just missed it. But also sort of a larger version of that question, like when you're dealing with things that you're passionate about and when you're looking for, you know, the places that you should invest your time and energy, how do you assess whether you're the person to do it? And how do you receive the kind of criticism when someone says, you know, maybe we're on board in general, but this is the place for someone else's voice? Like, what is that process like for you? And again, we can leave this out of the interview if you want.
Yeah, it doesn't matter to me. I'm glad to talk about that. I'm not sure how interesting it is to everybody, but it, first of all, I think the example you gave is great because Twitter did what Twitter does. You know, it blew something out of proportion that, like, I never said that I was writing a book about abortion. And yet that's, you know, what ended up kind of spiraling into this kind of side conversation that I didn't really address because it wasn't even accurate. You know, I said I was writing a book on the sanctity of life and the idea that every person's made in the image of God. And that's what I'm writing on right now. And so why that's important is because I want to connect the dots on some of these issues that we're talking about, like gun violence, death penalty.
Can I just interject really quick? So
totally.
You're absolutely right. You said, I'm writing a book about the sanctity of life. I'd love to hear your thoughts. But then you included a poll, and the question for the poll was, when does life begin? So you can understand why the readers would have assumed you were writing a book about abortion.
Yeah. So what part of what I'm hoping to do is expand people's view of a sanctity of life, that it's not just something that exists in the womb, but it's something that exists, you know, there's life after birth as much as there's life before birth. But I will talk about abortion. And I think we need a better conversation on abortion. And certainly we need to center the voices of women in that. So I've held two town halls along with my partner and friend, Lisa Sharon Harper. So we had two, you know, hour and a half conversations on it. And that has all been a part of shaping the parts of the book that will address abortion, including people I really value, like my wife and other folks that have a lot to say about it and a lot of credibility to say it. So I'm not going to leave out abortion, but it's not a book on abortion. It's a book on a better ethic of life. And yeah, so that's what I'm writing right now. Does that make sense?
So, but the other part of the question is, how do you decide if you're like the person to say a thing. Or, you know, as a white guy, and I have a small platform with this podcast, and I want to use part of that. And I have a small platform as being, you know, a teacher of philosophy to university students, and I try to use those platforms to advance causes that don't directly pertain to me. And so this is something I encounter sometimes, too. There are voices of people in these communities doing this work and have been doing it for longer than I've been aware of it. Maybe my position is just to point to them, right? Maybe it would be a better use of my time and a more honoring thing to do for them to just elevate them as much as I can and keep my own mouth shut. So this is something I struggle with and think about. And so I'm curious how you process things like that.
Yeah. Well, so I think one of the first things that I did as I was thinking about abortion, a group of all guys read Dorothy Roberts' book, Killing the Black Body. And that was partly because my friend Elena Ramsey, who was the executive director of Red Letter Christians at the time and is a very passionate reproductive rights activist, and she suggested we read that book. So a bunch of us read that together. Then we started expanding this conversation. So I think the point that you make is a really important one, which is I always want to be in conversation with the people who have been directly impacted. And I think there's a lot of times where I shouldn't be holding the mic. I should be, or I shouldn't be grabbing the mic. I should be holding it for them to speak on, you know, immigration, the death penalty, folks that are wrongfully convicted. So many of the events that we're crafting, even around the Forge, are centering the people who have been impacted by gun violence, you know, doing events that around the death penalty where folks that are wrongfully convicted are in the forefront. Our panels on abortion that we hosted at Red Letter Christians all had multiple people who had abortions for various reasons. And so those stories need to be in the forefront. Now, I think that, you know, there's a discernment question, and you know, when to write a book. Am I the right person to write a book? And I usually bounce that off of some really close friends that you know, when I have an idea that I feel like the spirit's stirring in me, I bounce that off some friends and say, I think I'm going to write about this. What do you think? And on the abortion section of this book, I'm grateful to have a whole bunch of people that are helping inform my thinking on that. But we've like dudes have done a lot of damage. We've done a lot of violence in the world. And, you know, I think it's 85% of homicides are done by men. We need to correct some of the message and the faithfulness, you know, to Jesus when it comes to those things. So yeah, man, I guess those are my ponderings on that. And I mean, pretty much every book I've done has been in partnership with other people except especially people that have been impacted. So like for the death penalty, I interviewed wrongfully convicted people, executioners, murder victims, family members, you know, and so I'm trying to do some of that same hard work on this book.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like using your voice and your platform to give a voice to the voiceless, which I think is our job is white American men, to be honest with you. Yeah.
Yeah. Or even to amplify the voices people are not listening to. Right. Yeah. Like, cause sometimes we kind of ambitiously seek to be a voice for the voiceless when they have a voice. And that's where I think it's kind of what you're saying though, is that rather than we want to like help rip away the layers of things that people are, you know, holding their hands up, not listening to the people they should be. So yeah, it's good, y'all. Well, it's thanks for Shane. The conversation. Yeah, let's do it again sometime.
Yes, Shane Kellyborn, thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure. And everyone, Irresistible Revolution, Jesus for President, there's a number of different amazing resources that Shane can just help round out and center you more in Jesus. So thanks for sharing yourself with us, Shane.
Absolutely. Appreciate awesome. You guys. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar. We hope you enjoyed the episode, and if you did, please rate and review the podcast before you close your app. You can also share the episode with friends or family members with the links from our social media pages. Gain inside access, extra perks, and more at patreon.com/apastorandaphilosopher. We're so grateful for your support of the podcast. Until next time, this has been A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar.